Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Emily Barson, co-founder and executive director of United States of Care. It's a nonpartisan consortium of some of the top health policy analysts, health industry stakeholders, and patients advocacy groups, all committed to improving access to healthcare for all Americans. Lori Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She looked at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Emily Barson, Executive Director of United States of Care, on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Emily Barson, Executive Director of United States of Care, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to advancing access to affordable health care for all Americans, seeking to put health care over politics. Previously, she served for 8 years at the Department of Health and Human Services under President Barack Obama, most recently as Director of the Intergovernmental and External Affairs. Prior to that, Ms. Barson, she earned a degree in political communications from George Washington University School of Media and Public Affairs. Emily, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and congratulations. You and Andy Slavitt co-founded the United States of Care, and you've really put together a great coalition of people from health policy, health industry from around the country. You've got names that are familiar to many of our listeners, Atul Gawande, Mark Cuban, Tom Daschle, Governor Stephen Beshear, and Dr. Don Berwick, as well as Michael Levitt. And I'm wondering if you could just tell our listeners how all of these people came together under the banner of United States of Care, and what's the unifying mission?
Well, we were founded around a simple but very ambitious mission to ensure that every single American has access to affordable health care. We believe there's more that unites Americans than divides us in healthcare, and that refocusing the discussion around everyday Americans and their experiences is a key step in any successful discussion of reforms or expanding healthcare access. You mentioned some of the more notable members of our Founders Council. We are grateful, certainly, that they've all signed on in support of that mission and lending their considerable expertise, certainly. What I would say is the Founders Council members that I think are the most compelling and really important to our work are the ones you haven't heard of. We have representatives from the patient advocacy community, disability activists. We've got parents of medically complex children and others who really help us in our mission to keep the patient experience front and center in our work. Those are people like Elena Hung, who co-founded an organization called Little Lobbyists, and people like Lan Senna, who's one of the patients and community advocates at the center of the New Mexico coalition we've partnered with that has been advocating for Medicaid buy-in in that state.
Well, Emily, I think it's safe to say that as a nation, we've been through quite a dramatic roller coaster of a ride, maybe starting with the crafting and the passage of the Affordable Care Act, its implementation, and then all the challenges that we've seen as the years went on. And it has triggered really pretty profound changes in the American healthcare system, expanding coverage for tens of millions of formerly uninsured Americans. And of course, we've seen that it heightens some of the political divide in the country. But what's really fascinating about your work, it seems, is that you're creating a framework for policy discussions that rises above politics and above those political divides and really seeks to unite the country around this critical issue of healthcare. Talk to us about how you're seeking to redirect this narrative around this critical issue of healthcare in America.
As you mentioned, the last many years of national discussion around healthcare have certainly been dominated by the ACA, and we're really excited to create this framework and be able to move beyond the current political fray and look to the next set of innovative policies that can continue making progress towards our ultimate mission. The politics have gotten in the way, and most especially so at the federal level. We don't see there's a lot of prospects for federal progress, at least in the next couple of years. And that's why our approach is really focused at the state level to build an evidence base of what can be scalable and bring more relief to people in those states in the short term, while we have this broader conversation about what the future of healthcare in this country can look like. And we've certainly seen a lot more promising momentum for bipartisanship at the state level and the ability to move beyond the politics than we currently see in Washington. That's really why we're trying to take politics out of being the center of the discussion and focusing on the patients. We know that when you or someone in your family needs healthcare, it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat, you just want to be able to go see the doctor. And we think that should be the underlying goal at the center of any healthcare reforms and keeping those experiences front of mind.
Emily, I like a couple of things that you've said, that there's more that unites us than divides us, and clearly that politics has gotten in the way. But we're entering already the cycle of the 2020 presidential race. We've got many Democrats who've declared an interest in promoting Medicare for all. I'm just wondering, based on your own experience, what health policy issues do you believe will resonate most strongly with voters in this 2020 campaign cycle?
Well, I will say, you know, I'm not in the business of giving political advice. We're a policy-focused nonprofit organization. I will say that, you know, what we find promising is seeing a focus on the end goal, you know, of making sure everyone in America can access the health care that they need. There are a lot of proposals that will be debated both on the campaign trail as well as proposals that have been introduced in Congress. That's great. And I think having a real exchange of ideas and testing out what makes sense is going to be positive for getting to the end goal of reform. And from our perspective, what's most important is that the voices of patients and families are heard. And we'll be watching to see which ideas among the discussion meet our underlying principles, which is, first, everyone should have an affordable, regular source of care. Second, that no one should face financial hardship or have to make choices between paying for health care for themselves and their family and other expenses in their life. And third, that reforms should be done in a way that's politically and financially sustainable so that people won't feel nervous that their health care is going to be at risk depending on the results of each election cycle or who's controlling Congress or their governor's mansion. We think those are really the principles that we're organized around. We're not advocating behind one particular policy approach. We think there's a lot of ways to get there, and that's why we want to start building out those learnings on the ground.
Well, Emily, I think one of the things that we've all learned a lot about is how to improve access to health coverage to people having health insurance by expanding Medicaid. That was certainly a key part of the Affordable Care Act. I was really interested in your initiative at United States of Care that seeks to expand on that example with a Medicaid buy-in initiative, which I understand is gaining interest in many states as a possible way to provide even more affordable coverage options to people. Can you talk about this initiative and the Medicaid buy-in playbook that you've created?
Sure. Medicaid is a healthcare program that's run through the states. And it's a state-federal partnership, so both governments pick up part of the cost of providing care. Populations that get Medicaid are people like kids, pregnant women, children with disabilities. Under the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid expanded to more populations in states that decided to expand their program to cover low-income adults. And now, as you mentioned, as many as a dozen states have been considering a Medicaid buy-in approach that would build on the framework of Medicaid in their states and allow more people to pay to buy coverage. And this is something that we find appealing because it's an approach states can look at now, building on a framework of a program that is efficient and popular at providing healthcare coverage. Medicaid buy-in would allow states to tailor a program to what their particular population needs. And that could be around specific populations like rural communities or small businesses, or it could be providing a more widely available option. And part of our approach at United States of Care is sharing learnings, you know, gathering what the best things that people are doing in states and making sure that other states aren't starting from scratch. So what we've done is created a set of resources on Medicaid buy-in to do just that. They can all be found at MedicaidBuyIn.com, which has a map tracking activity in this area across the country. And there's a video explaining what Medicaid buy-in means. And as you said, there's what we're calling a Medicaid buy-in playbook, which is an actionable roadmap that advocates or lawmakers who might be thinking about this as a solution for their state can use to figure out what problems they're trying to solve and pull together policy and coalition-based information about how to make it happen.
We're speaking today with Emily Barson, Executive Director of United States of CARE, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to advancing access to affordable health care for all Americans. She served at the Department of Health and Human Services, most recently as Director of Intergovernmental and External Affairs. You know, I think we've always had the view that states are engines of innovation. And also, I think it's probably a place more likely to have a conversation with real people. And we've seen some states like Massachusetts and Maryland have created some great examples of improving access to care. What are you seeing out in the states in terms of innovations and solutions that others might emulate?
We couldn't agree more. We believe also that states are the laboratories of democracy and innovation and allow for policy innovation that meets their needs and that other states can learn from, as well as informing policy at a national level. You know, you mentioned Maryland. Last week, they advanced a bill around easy enrollment. This was passed by an overwhelming margin with bipartisan support. And this is legislation that would establish a simpler system for people who need to find health coverage. In fact, it would let uninsured Marylanders start the enrollment process just by checking a box on their state income tax return. And from there, they can find out if they're eligible for financial assistance and be enrolled into coverage. Another example is in North Carolina, which passed and got approval for a first-of-its-kind Medicaid waiver that's funding what they call the Healthy Opportunities Program. And what this does is an attempt to directly address non-medical drivers of health. And what makes this program so groundbreaking, it's the first time that CMS is allowing a state to use Medicaid funds to directly provide services like nutritious food or housing services, some of those non-medical items that we know impact people's actual health care and the underlying costs in the system. So we're really excited to learn what the results of that demonstration will be. And even here in United States of CARE, we are working to bring stakeholders together to collaborate, you know, also on looking at some of the health equity and non-medical drivers of health that impact people's actual health care as well as the cost. So, you know, there's a lot of exciting momentum happening throughout the country.
Well, Emily, wrapped around all of this is this ever-present concern about costs. And while we've seen some slower growth in costs in some areas, we still see premiums that go up, the share that people have to pay out of pocket being unsustainable for some people. And of course, the cost of pharmaceuticals remains just a very big issue. Tell me what the United States of CARE is doing around making recommendations or innovations around this larger issue of the cost of care.
Certainly, in addition to looking at some, you know, some of those programs that address, you know, the social determinants, which, you know, we do think ultimately will require systemic change to bring down those costs. I think drug costs and the underlying pain that people feel every month when they go to fill their prescriptions is real. And we have put out some tips for states about levers that state lawmakers can take around controlling those costs. And it's also been one of the areas that has been heartening to see bipartisan interest at both the state and the federal level in addressing when, you know, a quarter of people are leaving the pharmacy without filling their prescription because of cost. We know this is a real issue that needs to be prioritized. There are also other, you know, costs that consumers are really feeling the pain. You know, you show up at the hospital to get care and weeks or months later get hit with a surprise bill for an out-of-network provider. And this has also been an area that we've seen bipartisan action. Mm-hmm. You know, as an example, in Texas, there's been bipartisan legislation to address this issue, in effect, taking the patient out of having to be the middleman between providers and insurance companies. And we know that healthcare costs, both to consumers and throughout the system, are escalating. And we need to find ways to, you know, to really bring down that cost curve and reduce the overall costs of providing that care.
You know, healthcare is a large section of our GDP. I don't know what it is, 18-19%. It continues to rise, but it employs lots of people, right? And there's a whole group of folks who are working to try to make it more efficient. But where do you come down in terms of what the impact will be? Do you think we can have an efficient, effective, economical reduction in our healthcare costs and not have a disruption in the workforce and somehow lower this total amount of GDP substantially? As you sort of model this up, what happens to that workforce if there's no opportunities for growth in the healthcare world?
Yeah, you know, we certainly have reason to be optimistic. I think there, you know, there is a renewed interest in addressing that cost curve. You know, you've acknowledged that there's a lot of people employed in the healthcare system, and whether that's, you know, people at hospitals or providers, and we want to make sure that that it's organized in a way that's most efficient and providing care to the most people. Many approaches have focused, you know, on the uninsured population, and, you know, certainly have made progress towards addressing those needs. But, you know, we know that half of Americans are covered by insurance through their jobs, and millions of people are covered by Medicare and Medicaid. And it's exciting to see employers at the table. They're going to need to be part of the solution. And, you know, I think we know there isn't a single silver bullet or a single approach, you know, that we think is the solution to everything. But we know that we need all the stakeholders to be there. And that includes people who are providing that care, people who are working in the healthcare industry. And that's also, you know, why we've made sure that leaders from nonprofit care providers and doctors and nurses are all part of the conversation in our work on the Founders Council.
We've been speaking today with Emily Barson, Executive Director of United States of Care, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that's dedicated to advancing access to affordable health care for all Americans, putting health care over politics. You can learn more about their work by going to unitedstatesofcare.org or follow them on Twitter at US of Care. Emily, we want to thank you for your many years of dedicated public service in the health policy arena, for the work that you're doing to advance health care for all Americans, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thanks for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Democratic lawmakers claim the president's proposed 2020 budget would ransack or slash Medicare and Medicaid, likening it to an assault on Medicare and the health care of seniors and families across America. Experts agree the proposed cuts to Medicaid are significant, but many of the Medicare proposals echo those of Barack Obama and wouldn't directly affect beneficiaries. It's important to note that a president's budget proposal is more a symbolic statement of priorities than something Congress would actually vote on. President Donald Trump's proposed 2020 budget includes a net $777 billion reduction in Medicaid spending and funding for the Affordable Care Act marketplace subsidies over 10 years. Those cuts would come from repealing the ACA, including the Medicaid expansion, and turning Medicaid into a block grant program. As for Medicare, a program politicians of both parties often highlight in lines of attack, those proposed spending reductions total a net $515 billion to $575 billion over 10 years, depending on how they're measured. Notably, several of the Medicare proposals in Trump's budget are similar to cost-cutting measures Obama had proposed when he was president. For instance, proposals to reduce post-acute care payments and to cut payments for bad debt are similar to Obama policies, the budget watchdog group said. In fact, Obama's fiscal 2017 budget proposal included reduced post-acute care payments. The Trump budget proposals to pay the same for outpatient services, whether in a doctor's office or other facilities, and to change graduate medical education payments are expansions of Obama proposals. At least one of the Trump administration's proposals, a change in out-of-pocket costs for Medicare Part D prescription drug coverage, would directly affect beneficiaries, causing some to pay less and others to pay more. Paul N. Vandewater, a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, told us that besides the prescription drug benefit change and perhaps a medical liability reform, the proposals in Trump's budget, quote, would not directly affect beneficiaries. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Anxiety disorders are on the rise among the nation's youth, and experts in the field of child psychology feel the condition starts much earlier in childhood, with an estimated 1 in 5 children being affected. But too often, these so-called internalizing disorders go undiagnosed. Unlike children with more expressive conditions such as ADHD or autism spectrum disorder, young kids struggling with anxiety or depression often internalize their symptoms and may just seem like an introvert to the casual observer. University of Vermont child psychologist Ellen McGinnis says the process of diagnosis for younger children is often painstaking and can take months to confirm.
I was actually doing my dissertation, and the whole point of it was to find an objective assessment battery for children with internalizing disorders, because they have similar things for children with externalizing disorders and for autism, but not anxiety and depression, which I think are the most overlooked disorders in that age group.
Dr. McGinnis says the traditional method of diagnosis involves creating scenarios that induce anxiety, followed by behavioral observation by clinicians, and the results can be inexact. So she teamed up with her husband and fellow researcher, biomedical engineer Ryan McGinnis, to create a wearable sensor that can pick up on physical cues that suggest the presence of anxiety, using accelerometers and simple algorithms to compare normal stress responses.
So the device is called an inertial measurement unit, and so we strap that to a belt on each child, and it has an accelerometer in it, and so we're able to pick up angular velocity, speed, how much the child is bending forward and backward, things like that. And it actually picks up 100 samples per second, so much more than the, you know, eye can see. So we were able to see if kids with anxiety and depression move differently in response to a potential threatening information. And they do. So kids with a disorder turn further away from the potential threat than kids without a disorder.
Dr. McGinnis says one of the most promising aspects of this device is that it can pick up anxiety and depression disorder symptoms in a matter of minutes instead of months. Their research paper published in the publication Plus One shows the device was nearly 85% accurate in making a correct diagnosis. And she says early diagnosis is the key to avoiding more damaging manifestations of anxiety disorder later on.
What's really great about it is that we increase the sensitivity compared to subjective parent reports and, you know, questionnaires that they filled out. So we're picking up more kids who might have gone previously undetected.
A simple, wearable tool that can assist parents and clinicians in determining if a child is suffering from anxiety disorder, leading to less guesswork and more rapid diagnosis and treatment. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. This show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.